Today's scripture reading comes from the book of Job. The book of Job, chapter 1. We'll read through to Job, chapter 2, verse 10. Job, chapter 1. There was a man in the land of Uz, whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the peoples of the east. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord and said, Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. And the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck them down, the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine at their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose, and tore his robes, and shaved his head, and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself to the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin, and that a man, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to his face." to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery which with him to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all of this, Job did not sin with his lips.
Due to having officiate a number of funerals in the last couple of weeks and working 13 days straight and needing to take a couple extra days off last week, I wasn't able to prepare to my satisfaction a message in our current series on the church and its purposes, particularly as we look at evangelism. And we'll resume with that next week. So what I did for today was I took an old sermon from a previous church and I reworked it, and I chose this morning Job. And this section of scripture, and the theme that runs through it that I want to discuss with you or present to you is worshiping God through suffering. And though this really isn't a complete break from our series, in a sense, because we saw earlier in our series as we looked at what is our purposes as God's church, our greatest and our primary purpose is to worship God. And so we spent March and April looking at what does it mean as God's people to worship Him? What are the elements of worship? What are the different aspects of worship? And we defined worship, or I defined worship for you then, as our response in, in and through Jesus Christ to God's revealing of Himself in deed and word, by our declaring His worth and giving the glory due Him through various proper attitudes and actions. And the thing is we have to remember that our responding to God, to who He is, what He has done for us in the proper way, is not something that we just do when life's going well. Our response of worship is not something that only occurs when we're feeling comfortable and we're content. But we must worship God when life crashes down around us and when we hurt. And Job is a man, as you've seen from this text, who experienced incredible suffering. The intensity of suffering and the scope of suffering was immense for him. And he teaches us, or we can learn from him, three pillars that we need to put into our life, that we need to build as foundations into our life, so that when these times come and life crashes in amongst us and we hurt and we're confused and we're thrown about, we can still worship. We can still respond to who God is and how He's revealing Himself and what He's doing with appropriate responses that give Him the glory, that give Him the honor. So the first foundation is that worship is a way of life. So it says there in Job chapter 1, verse 1, it describes him with four different words. And these four different words in verse 1 tell us, or they are the evidence that Job, for Job, worship was a way of life. It was something that he did all the time. And this is how then he was able to respond as he did with worship. Very briefly, these four words. First one is blameless. Now that word, blameless, when it is applied in the scriptures to humans, does not mean sinless perfection. It's not saying that Job never did any wrong or that he'd never ever committed any sin. The word blameless is referring to his integrity. His general state was that he was a man of honesty, a man who is trustworthy, a man who is pure and did what is right. That was his general character and way of dealing with people. So a blameless man or a blameless person was someone who walks in close fellowship with God and obeys the laws of God. We find this stated in Psalm chapter 119, verse 1. It says, "Blessed are those whose way is blameless, who walk in the law of the Lord." He's described as being upright. Being upright has the idea of faithfulness and attachment to the law and the words of God and his rules. In 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 7b to 8, God told King Jeroboam this: "Because I exalted you from among the people and made you leader over my people Israel, and tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you, and yet you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commandments and followed me with all his heart, doing only that which was right in my eyes." So Jeroboam was someone who was not upright. He was not attached. He did not faithfully follow the laws and the rules of God like David did. But being upright is not only that attachment and devotion to living out God's laws. Being upright refers to how you treat other people, that you treat other people with honesty and integrity as well, and you're compassionate towards them. Because if you are committed to God's laws and rules, many of God's laws and rules tell us how to treat one another. And so Job says this in Job chapter 31, verses 13 to 23. He says, you know, "I've been an upright person. I have not taken advantage of my servants. I've treated my servants well. When I saw the orphan and the widow, I took care of them. I looked after them. I helped them." So he says, "I'm innocent. I'm an upright person." And then thirdly, he feared God. The one who fears God approaches God with great reverence, with awe, with the desire not to displease God or to bring dishonor to him and his name. The one who fears God is reverent towards God. They have a great consciousness of God's character, of his love, of his mercy, of his holiness, of his righteousness, of his justice. And they don't want to offend God. They see him as so great and so awesome. They want to just please him and live for him. And they express that in their life. And you can see this in Job's role as the spiritual leader of his family. We're in verse 5 of chapter 1. It was his regular practice to send for his children after their parties and to offer sacrifices for them, to have them consecrated or purified, because he thinks, you know, who knows, they may have cursed God in their partying. And so that was something he regularly did. It shows that he feared God. And the fourth trait or word that describes Job here that shows worship was a lifestyle, a way of life for him, was that he shunned evil. Now, actually, earlier on April 14th, we looked at this concept specifically from Amos chapter 5. If you remember, we explored that passage and we learned the main point from that point, that passage in Amos 5 was the ritual, formal worship services and actions that we do as God's people to worship him, they're necessary, they're right, we need to do them, but that's not all there is to worship. We can come to our formal worship services, but we also need to keep worshiping, responding to who God is, responding to what he is saying and doing in our life all week long. And Amos chapter 5 showed us we do that by living lives of justice, lives of righteousness, lives of goodness and kindness towards others and fairness. So we cannot just come and worship God on Sunday and then live like the devil the rest of the week. So we have to shun evil. Job, as part of his ordinary common worship that he did all the time. He said in Job 31, verses 1 to 28, he tells his friends that, you know, I have actively shunned evil. I keep my eyes from lust. I keep my eyes from adultery. I keep myself from injustice, and I treat my business co-workers honestly. I do not rip them off. I'm not dishonest in my dealings. I'm not an idolater. So he shunned evil. So these four characteristic traits, where Job is blameless, where he fears God, he's upright, he shuns evil, this is evidence. This shows us that his whole way of life is one of a way of worshiping God, a way of responding to God, walking with God, fearing God, living for God, obeying God 24/7. And that is what enabled him to have a foundation so that when everything fell apart, what's his response? Not cursing God, but worshiping God. I like what Mike Mason writes, and I quote, "For we know that under such circumstances, worship does not come to a person naturally or spontaneously, but rather it is a practice response, a fruit of long faith and discipline. Job could never have reacted as he did unless he had been practicing for this moment all his life." End of quote. So that's the first foundation. Is that a foundation you have been building and developing in your life? That you are worshiping 24/7. You're worshiping all the time. And you are growing in that. Second foundation that Job understood and built into his life is that we own nothing and all is on loan from God. In a matter of minutes, before one servant could finish his tragic reporting of a disaster, another servant comes and interrupts him with more devastating news, and so within moments, Job loses everything. He is made destitute. His world falls apart. His economic engine, his livestock, the camels, the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, they're all gone. Destroyed or stolen, many of his servants killed, and then his own children, all of them taken from him at once. And what was his response? As we read in Job 1, 20 to 22, he arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. The only way Job could have responded like that and said, "Blessed be God," is if he understood and had accepted earlier in his life that he owns nothing. That everything that God had given him was just on loan. And it wasn't his in any permanent form. See, God, as Job says, brings us into this life. God brings us into this world with nothing. We own nothing, we have nothing when we are born. And then when God ends our life, where we depart, we take nothing with us. We leave everything behind and we take nothing. And in between those two poles, birth and death, God provides and God loans to us everything that we acquire. He grants to us all our abilities and the achievements that we do, all the skills that we have, all the cars we'll own, all the clothes we'll wear, all the education we will achieve, all the money we will possess, all the homes we will live in, all the family and friends we will know, these are loaned to us, granted to us from God. And at various points in our life, he'll start to take some of them away. And at the end of our life, we leave them all behind. Now, this is hard for us to accept this because in our culture in the West, we are taught and we are growing up with the thought and the false belief that our life gets its meaning and we get our personal worth from what we possess or from what we achieve. In our society, a person is valued by what they can do and how much they can or have not achieved, or what their status is, or what they possess. If certain people possess more higher-end goods, and they get more attention. If someone has less in our society, they get less attention. They're considered less valuable. It is foolish and dumb to present or to base our identity of who we are and our self-worth on our possessions, because they're not ours anyway. They're God's, and they're so transient. And the fashions and what's in one day changes the next, so you're constantly chasing and reforming your identity and your self-worth. It keeps going up and down. Our self-worth and our identity is based on one thing, who we are in Jesus Christ. On Jesus, who is the same today, tomorrow, and was the same yesterday. So our worth and our identity in Jesus Christ, in our union with Him, is secure and it never changes. It's very freeing when you understand that. Remember what Jesus said in Luke chapter 12, verse 14. He says, our life does not consist in what we possess. Now it's true, it's hard to lose some of our possessions. It's hard to lose a close family member. It's hard to lose maybe a house that you built or it was your dream home and it's destroyed in a fire. Job, a righteous man, a blameless man, an upright man, a man who feared God, he sorrowed, he grieved when he lost everything. It hurts. Yet, when we recognize that everything is from God, and He gives and He takes away, hopefully our attitude can be this: my Master sees fit to relieve me of my things. He has plans. I will submit to Him and offer myself as the living sacrifice to Him in worship, holy and pleasing to God. But we can only do that if we accept the truth. Everything we have and everything we've done, all our skills and abilities and all our possessions are on loan, and they're not ours to keep. We've got to keep them in an open palm. Sometimes we foolishly think God owes us certain things, that He must give us certain possessions or do certain things for us. Well, if we think that God owes us things, and if that's our attitude, well, we're not going to worship God acceptably in the good times, let alone the crises. When we must learn to trust and worship God for simply who He is. We must simply learn to look at God and His nature and His being and His character. And that's why we worship. That's why we respond to Him, because of just who He is. We must not worship Him because of what He gives us or how comfortable He makes our life. That's at the heart of the wager between Satan and God. God boasts about Job. You see my great servant over here? You see how blameless and wonderful he is? Do you see how he loves me? And Satan replied in what? In chapter 1, verse 9 to 11? Does God fear Job for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all he has, and he'll curse you to your face. So Job is implying that Job worships God not because of who God is, but because Job likes the good things that God has given to him. He says, Satan is saying, Job's worship is not sincere. God, Job's pulling the wool over your eyes. Job doesn't really love you just because you're you and you're the greatest and most awesome being in the universe, that is worthy of our honor and our full devotion. No, he doesn't worship you because of that. He worships you because you've made him rich. And you've protected him and given him all these material things. So it's the things he really loves, God, not you. So take away the things and you'll see. I'll show you. You'll see that, you know, he'll curse you because he loves the things more than he loves you. Well, thankfully, wonderfully, Satan was wrong. Job, when stripped of everything he had, he worshiped God. And how could he do that? Because he knew that everything that he had was on loan from God. So that was the second foundation that Job had in his life that enabled him to respond this way. The third foundation was that he understood God is in perfect control and God knows what's best for us. So we can accept both trouble and good, or trouble and adversity, or evil and good from God. After the second assault from Satan, where God allows Satan to harm Job's body, Job's wife, who also suffered the same losses of Job, she suffered the devastating economic loss to the family, she suffered the death of the 10 children, she encourages Job in chapter 2, verse 9, to curse God and die. And Job's response in verse 10, he says to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speak." Foolish doesn't mean stupid or intellectually challenged. Foolish here means like an unbeliever. You speak of someone who, the fool, who says in their heart, there is no God. So he says, "Woman, you're talking like an unbeliever. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?" And all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now we read the context. It's clear. The buck stops with God. So ultimately, you know, it's God who allowed Satan to attack Job. It's God who allowed Satan to take away and harm all his things and harm him. It's God who determines the exact limits that Satan could go up to. So ultimately, you trace it back, God allows all this to happen to Job. But Job doesn't know any of this. He doesn't know this conversation or these conversations between God and Satan. Job has no clue that God was bragging about him to his greatest adversary. He has no clue that God is so proud of him and God takes so much enjoyment in his righteous living and his worship. So Job, all Job knows is God allowed all this to happen and allowed all this trouble, this evil to come into his life. And so his initial attitude is, "I'm just going to trust God. He knows what he's doing, and I can receive from God whatever he allows in my life, whether it be evil to come into my life or whether it be good to come into my life. He has his reasons, whatever they may be. I don't know what they are. I don't understand them." And actually, Job never does understand, or he doesn't get an answer from God as to why these things happened. One cannot truly accept trouble from God unless we accept God's character as trustworthy. And Job does. So he continues in active faith. When everything falls apart and is taken from him, he continues to exhibit his trust and his fear of God, and he worships because he trusts God. He knows God's in perfect control. So three concluding thoughts then to reflect and to act upon. First thing, build your foundation of faith strong before the crisis comes. Just as a person intends to run a marathon, they don't just train and prepare themselves to run a marathon by an occasional run around the track, and then when the day comes and they go to the marathon and expect to finish, you're right. You don't run a marathon or equip yourself to run a marathon by running around the track once a week. You will not finish the marathon. So similarly, we will not be prepared to bow and honor God and trust him to save us when life falls apart unless we have already built these foundations into our life, the foundations of worshiping as a way of life, the foundation that we understand God owns everything and everything we have is on loan from him, and the foundation that God is in perfect control and is trustworthy and knows what is best for us so we can accept good and evil from him. So we need to start to build those things into our life now and use these as we experience the small little difficulties and the small little troubles. And then we will be prepared for when the larger crises hit, when the severe trials come, when God allows severe difficulty into our life, and when he allows us to have difficult times of testing, then we'll be ready. But we have to build these things into our life before the crisis comes. We won't be able to just to pick up these things and run with it and respond in worship when it happens. Second thing to think about and reflect and act upon is realize that testing doesn't always come in adversity, but also when things are going well. Now, Satan likes to use the times of trouble and evil in our life to make us give up our faith, to accuse God of wrongdoing, to curse God, and to walk away from God. But you may not presently be in a hard place right now. You might not be struggling. Things may be going very well with you, but realize that in your prosperity, Satan is amply there, ready and able to tempt you as well. Because in our prosperity, we can easily forget that second foundation that everything comes from God. We can begin to think, oh, what I achieved, I did it on my own strength. What I own, I purchased and I possessed by my own choice and my own effort, and it's mine. This is my kingdom, my house, my land. And in our prosperity, we get proud, and we've already fallen into the trap of the devil. Moses warned the Israelites of this in Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 6 to 20. And actually, I'd encourage you to go home and read Deuteronomy chapter 8 today. He told the Israelites, he says, once God brings you into the promised land, and you get settled in the houses you didn't build, and you start reaping from vineyards you didn't plant and olive groves you didn't plant, and God increases your wealth and the number of animals that you have, and you're comfortable, Moses says, don't forget that God gave that to you. Do not go around and start saying, as you survey your fields, look what I did with the might of my hands, and forget God and become an idolater. Remember, it was God who gave you the strength to till the land. It was God who gave you the brains to figure out the certain ways of business plans or whatever. He gives you all good things and abilities. So realize that, you know, testing comes when we're comfortable and things are going well. And we can stop worshiping God as we should in those times because we think we have done everything and we don't need God. And then lastly, the thought I leave with you is worship of God includes tears, crying, and expressions of agony. So what did Job do in chapter 1, verse 20? He hears all this devastating news. He rips his robe. He shaves his head, and then he falls on the ground in worship. Well, ripping your robe and shaving your head were ancient forms of showing publicly your grief and your sadness and your being upset and your sorrow. So he's showing his sorrow and then he falls into the ground while he's sorrowful and grieving and worships. So in his agony, in his tears, he's worshiping. John Piper comments, "The magnificence of Job's worship is because it was in grief, not because it replaced grief." Don't ever think that you can't worship God because you're grieving, or you're hurting, or you're confused, etc. You can worship God when you're grieving, and worship Him with your tears and your aches and your pains. Don't ever think that you can't worship God because you don't feel happy, you don't have a smile splitting your lips, you're not bubbly and everything's okay. Yes, you can worship God in those difficult times, because remember, first of all, in all circumstances, it is God in His person that ignites our worship. We're responding to God and what He has said and what He has done. It's not our circumstances that determine whether we can worship or not. It's God Himself. And second, some of our worship requires our suffering. I said and defined that worship is our response to who God is and what He has said to us in appropriate manners and attitudes. Well, sometimes that appropriate manner or action to worship God in terms of responding to who He is and what He said, the appropriate form of worship is to suffer for Him. And therefore, when our worship requires an action of suffering on our part, all the more precious is the declaration of the worth of the honor we're giving to God through our tears, because it costs us and it shows we love Him more than we love our own pleasure and love our own comfort. So worship of God does include tears and crying and expressions of agony. Now the context of the letter of 1 Peter in the New Testament and the context of Job are very different contexts. But I will end with a verse from 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 9. In 1 Peter, Peter is speaking about persecution of Christians. They're suffering for doing right and living as God would have them do. Job's suffering from all the losses and the things that are going on behind the scenes in the spiritual world. But this verse applies, I think, for us, no matter what is causing our suffering. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 9. "Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good." I'll read that again. "Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will," so whether it was the Christians in the New Testament church who were suffering according to God's will, or Job who was suffering according to God's will, we need to entrust our souls to the faithful Creator and do good while doing good. I call the team to come forward and lead us in our song.